Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the MCG Pediatric Podcast. My name is Zach Hodges, and I'm a pediatric hospitalist here at the Medical College of Georgia. Today's discussion will be on maintenance IV fluids for pediatric inpatients, and we are joined by MCG pediatric intensivist Dr. Will Cagle. Hey, Dr. Cagle, thanks for coming on the show.
Morning, Zach. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me. This is an interesting topic, and it's something that's been pretty controversial over the last few years, so I think it's going to be a great topic for us to discuss today.
Excellent. Let's get started with the case. Our patient is a four-year-old female who was admitted from the emergency department to the inpatient ward with a history of fever, cough, shortness of breath, and decreased oral intake for the past 2 days. Chest radiograph in the emergency department is notable for an opacity in the right lower lobe, and she is diagnosed with pneumonia. She received antibiotics, an IV fluid bolus, and started on D5 half-normal saline maintenance IV fluids prior to arrival to the floor. She was continued on IV fluids overnight, but on the second hospital day, she was noted to have worsening irritability despite previously improving on her current therapy. Later in the day, she even developed a generalized tonic-clonic seizure that was not responsive to IV lorazepam. On arrival to the PICU, screening labs were notable for hyponatremia with a sodium of 118. Let's discuss what's possibly going on and how this complication may have been prevented.
Sure. This is a pretty interesting case, and unfortunately, it's something that happens too often. So this patient's likely suffering from hyponatremic encephalopathy that's worsened by the choice of IV fluids. This patient likely had some degree of dehydration on presentation to care and was appropriately resuscitated and started on maintenance IV fluid in the emergency department. Traditionally, hypotonic maintenance IV fluids have been the standard of care in pediatrics, so the choice of D5 half-normal saline is relatively common. But what we're now realizing is that giving our acutely ill patient hypotonic maintenance IV fluid increases the risk for iatrogenic hyponatremia, which can result in cerebral edema and even hyponatremic encephalopathy.
Okay, so that's a lot to unpack. First, what do you mean by hypotonic fluids?
Well, think back to medical school with me. Tonicity is essentially the force on the net flow of water across a semipermeable membrane. Remember that cells in a hypotonic solution tend to swell as water will move inside the cell by osmosis. On the other hand, cells that are put in a hypertonic solution tend to shrink as the water moves from inside the cell to outside. Tonicity is very similar to osmolarity, which is the amount of solute dissolved in a solution. For our patients, sodium is the main determinant of both tonicity and osmolarity, with glucose only contributing if there's severe hyperglycemia. Also remember that a normal serum sodium is about 135 to 145 milliequivalents per liter. For any fluid that has a sodium content of less than 130 milliequivalents per liter, we refer to as hypotonic. So a good example of hypotonic fluid is our standard D5 half-normal saline from your case. This fluid has 77 milliequivalents of sodium per liter, which is much lower than the normal serum value.
Okay, so hypotonic fluids are basically any fluid that has a sodium content of less than about 130 milliequivalents per liter. But why is this important for our patients? It seems like a stretch to say that our IV fluid choice is causing her hyponatremia. I feel like we see so many patients on the pediatric ward receiving hypotonic fluids, and they seem to do just fine.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Most hospitalized patients that receive hypotonic fluids never have any symptoms of hyponatremia. Unfortunately, as in this case, quite severe hyponatremia can develop before initial symptoms may even be present. Since the early 1990s, there's been an increase in concern of the risk of clinically significant hyponatremia associated with hypotonic fluid use in the general pediatric inpatients. As more evidence is accumulated, in 2018, the American Academy of Pediatrics published a clinical practice guideline on maintenance IV fluids to help provide physicians an evidence-based approach for prescribing maintenance fluids.
How big a problem is hyponatremia in hospitalized children? Is this something that we should be looking for every day?
Hyponatremia is likely much more common than most providers realize. Remember that hyponatremia is defined as a serum sodium less than 135 milliequivalents per liter. This is actually the most common electrolyte abnormality in hospitalized children. In fact, some studies have shown that it ranges between 15 and 30% of all admissions. We know that this is likely because patients who are acutely ill frequently have increased or so-called inappropriate secretion of antidiuretic hormone, also called ADH.
You mentioned antidiuretic hormone. ADH can be somewhat confusing because it's named after what it prevents, antidiuresis. I think that it might be helpful to think of ADH as the adds hydration hormone because it helps the kidney reabsorb water. But what do you mean by inappropriate secretion of ADH?
Well, ADH is the primary way that we regulate serum osmolarity. For instance, if our sodium is increasing due to free water loss, there's going to be an increased ADH secretion from our posterior pituitary gland. ADH then acts on the collecting ducts of the nephron to increase water reabsorption and reduce serum osmolarity. The clinical syndrome of inappropriate ADH secretion, also known as SIADH, means that there is ADH secretion from the posterior pituitary that's independent of the serum osmolarity.
So if ADH secretion is not due to increased osmolarity, what's causing it?
Well, it turns out there are actually many things that can cause ADH secretion. Probably the most significant is hypovolemia. In fact, if there is decreased blood volume, there will be an increased ADH secretion regardless of our serum osmolarity. This increased free water reabsorption may even cause hyponatremia, and this is why this syndrome is referred to as inappropriate ADH secretion. Maintaining an adequate circulating blood volume is so important that our physiology will actually sacrifice normal osmolarity in order to maintain blood pressure and perfusion. Unfortunately, hypotonic IV fluids, which provide an excess of free water in relation to the sodium content, given to patients with high levels of ADH, can lead to significant hyponatremia.
Okay, so let me make sure I'm understanding you. Serum osmolarity, or basically serum sodium, is the main determinant of ADH secretion in the posterior pituitary, and the job of ADH is to increase free water reabsorption in the nephron. But hypovolemia can also stimulate ADH release, and our patients who are dehydrated may continue to retain free water regardless of their serum osmolarity, and this can result in hyponatremia.
Yep, I think you got it. Hyperosmolarity and hypovolemia are the main triggers for ADH release, with the goal to retain more free water. Something that we haven't covered yet are the other triggers for ADH release that are also common in hospitalized patients. These can include everything from pain to nausea, postoperative states, and some medications like carbamazepine and chemotherapies. Also, children suffering from diseases that affect the lungs or the central nervous system, like pneumonia or meningitis, are at significant risk for SIADH as well.
Okay, so the take-home point is that SIADH is very common. The majority of patients admitted to the pediatric ward or ICU have risk factors for developing hyponatremia. Think of patients with pneumonia, dehydration, those receiving chemotherapy, and post-op. SIADH has even been a well-described complication of patients admitted after tonsillectomy, which is one of the most common surgeries in young children. So, if the risk of hyponatremia in hospitalized patients is so common, how did hypotonic fluids become the standard of care?
Well, most of the historical literature on maintenance fluid requirements for children are based on theoretical calculations from the 1950s. You remember Holliday and Seeker? I feel like everyone learns their method of calculating maintenance fluids at some point in medical school or residency. In these studies, fluid requirements were determined by using resting energy expenditure in healthy participants. What we know today is that fluid requirements in acutely ill patients are very different from these healthy controls, especially those who are admitted with severe illnesses to an ICU. Another interesting point is that the electrolyte concentration of IV fluids were originally designed to resemble the composition of human breast milk and not really based on the needs of sick children at all. With all of this, it's not surprising that historically our pediatric inpatients suffered high rates of electrolyte abnormalities, including hyponatremia.
Okay, so I understand that we don't want to cause electrolyte abnormalities, but why do we put so much focus on hyponatremia? It doesn't seem like an important patient-centered outcome.
Yeah, that's a great question, and really it's at the core of the controversy here. Like I said earlier, asymptomatic hyponatremia is very common in pediatric patients. We know that hyponatremia is an important marker of disease severity and associated with increased length of stay and healthcare expenditure. It is also associated with an increased risk of mortality in hospitalized patients. Unfortunately, in a cohort of hospitalized patients, a few of these children will develop clinically significant hyponatremia that may progress to cerebral edema and even hyponatremic encephalopathy, which in turn can lead to irreversible brain injury or even death if it's not quickly recognized or treated. Most of the hospital-acquired hyponatremic encephalopathy cases have occurred in otherwise healthy children who are receiving hypotonic IV fluids after only minor surgical procedures. This typically develops in less than 48 hours from the time of admission, leaving very little time for the child's brain to adapt.
The fact that hyponatremia can develop so quickly in a previously healthy patient and is associated with increased mortality is very concerning. We should definitely be thinking about this diagnosis in any hospitalized patient that develops altered mental status. Thinking back to clinical practice, on our service, we don't always get daily labs. Assuming I don't know what the sodium level is, clinically, when should I suspect hyponatremic encephalopathy?
So this is one of the very scary things about hyponatremia. The initial symptoms are nonspecific and include fuzziness, headache, nausea, vomiting, followed by confusion and lethargy as hyponatremia and cerebral edema worsen. Seizures, as in our case, can occur when hyponatremia is very severe or develops quickly. the high prevalence of asymptomatic hyponatremia paired with the nonspecific symptoms of early hyponatremic encephalopathy make this condition difficult to diagnose if you don't keep a high index of suspicion.
Okay, so what I'm gathering is that hyponatremia is very common, and the signs of cerebral edema and hyponatremic encephalopathy are very nonspecific. If we don't change our practice patterns to reduce the risk of hyponatremia, it's only a matter of time until we may miss a case of hyponatremic encephalopathy, which may lead to a bad outcome.
Yeah, that's right. And this is the main reason that the AAP published their maintenance IV fluid guidelines in 2018, to help pediatricians reduce the risk of hyponatremic encephalopathy in these hospitalized patients.
Okay, so after considering this basic physiology, let's get practical. What should we do next time we admit a pediatric patient to reduce the risk of hyponatremia?
First, something we don't talk about enough is to think of your IV fluid order in the same way you would a medication, like an antibiotic. Think about choosing the correct type, dose, and duration for every patient. Remember that maintenance fluid is only one part of the overall rehydration strategy of acutely ill patients. When patients present to the emergency room, they're commonly resuscitated with boluses of isotonic crystalloid to restore appropriate perfusion, then fluids are titrated down to the maintenance rate. As patients improved, IV fluids are weaned off as oral intake returns to normal. One way to reduce the risk of iatrogenic harm in hospitalized patients is to closely reassess your patients and turn off the IV fluid when it's no longer needed. But if your patient requires ongoing maintenance fluids, then you should probably choose something that's isotonic in most of the situations.
That's a very important point that I don't want us to miss. The most important thing to do for our patients is to thoughtfully choose the right dose and duration of IV fluids and then turn them off when they're no longer needed. But if you need ongoing maintenance IV fluids, isotonic is probably the best choice. What fluids are considered isotonic?
Remember that isotonic fluids are those that resemble the tonicity of human plasma. The most common isotonic fluid is 0.9% sodium chloride, also known as normal saline. It has a sodium and chloride concentration of 154 milliequivalents per liter. Another isotonic solution is plasmolite, which has a sodium of 140 and a chloride of 98. So this is an example of a balanced solution, which means that it has negative ions other than chloride to balance the solution. Lastly, lactated Ringer's, or LR, is another balanced crystalloid. It has a sodium of 130 and is considered to be near isotonic because of that slightly lower sodium content. LR contains some free water and in theory may contribute to hyponatremia, but nowhere near as often as half normal saline or other hypotonic solutions.
Okay, so those isotonic solutions include normal saline and plasmolite. Lactated Ringer's is considered nearly isotonic due to its sodium of 130. Let's say our patient needs ongoing maintenance fluids. Which type of isotonic fluid should we choose?
So, this is a very interesting question, but it's well beyond the scope of the guidelines. Plasmolite is typically much more expensive than saline or LR, which is why it's used less often in hospitals. The debate between saline and lactated Ringer's is ongoing, and unfortunately, there's very little evidence in pediatric patients. The 2018 pediatric guideline recommends using an isotonic solution that contains an appropriate amount of glucose and potassium based on the clinical situation. They did not specify between saline or balanced crystalloid. The take-home point is that for most of our patients, we should not use half-normal, and especially not quarter-normal saline, due to this increased risk of hyponatremia. Instead, we should use an isotonic solution.
Okay, so what are the pitfalls or side effects of isotonic therapy? What should we look out for?
First, let's cover conditions that were excluded from this guideline altogether. These guidelines were intended for infants and children between 28 days to 18 years of age. So this obviously excludes neonates, which have a very different fluid requirement, especially premature infants. Also, patients with neurosurgery, significant heart, kidney, or liver disease, cancer, diabetes insipidus, severe diarrhea or burns should also have a targeted fluid approach based on the specific clinical situation and are not included in this guideline. When thinking about what to look out for, patients receiving isotonic fluids are still at risk for developing hyponatremia. This, however, is much reduced compared to those receiving hypotonic fluids. On the other hand, in patients receiving isotonic fluids, there does not seem to be increased risk of developing hypernatremia, that being a serum sodium greater than 145 milliequivalents per liter. There is some concern that solutions such as normal saline with its increased chloride concentration may contribute to a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis and even increase the risk of acute kidney injury. Finally, the increased sodium content may contribute to fluid overload, which is why we need to be careful in those special circumstances of patients with heart and kidney disease. Overall, we need to pay close attention to our patients and don't simply turn off our brains because we chose an isotonic fluid. Repeated electrolyte testing and careful attention to fluid balance are both important strategies to reduce iatrogenic harm.
I'm glad that you highlighted which patients are not included in the AAP guideline. We will be sure to include a reference to the show notes if any of our listeners would like to read more about this topic. Coming back to our case, how often should we test electrolytes in patients receiving IV fluids?
Yeah, there's no perfect answer here. Some European guidelines recommend testing electrolytes every 24 hours in patients receiving maintenance fluids. It's reasonable to test once a day if you anticipate the child will receive IV fluids for the next 24 hours following. You also may need to test more frequently if your patient is at risk for developing electrolyte abnormalities, especially those patients that require large volume resuscitations or have other risk factors that we mentioned earlier. There's one key take-home point here. Don't run maintenance IV fluids for multiple days without testing intermittently. Otherwise, there is risk that you can harm your patient.
Great. Moving beyond the AAP guidelines, I wanted to discuss a little bit more about your thoughts when choosing saline or a balanced solution. How do you make that decision?
Like I said earlier, this is very controversial, with limited evidence in pediatrics, and much of the available data are from studies of adult patients. One notable, large, randomized crossover trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2018 that's worth mentioning is called the SMART trial. The SMART trial included over 15,000 adult ICU patients who received either exclusively saline or balanced crystalloids, such as LR or plasmolite, in multiple ICUs at Vanderbilt. Their primary outcome was a composite endpoint of 30 days, including mortality, new renal replacement therapy, or persistent renal dysfunction with a creatinine double from their baseline. In this trial, balanced crystalloids overall were narrowly favored with a slight reduced risk of mortality, new renal replacement therapy, or persistent renal dysfunction. As expected, patients receiving normal saline had higher chloride levels and persistence of acidosis longer than their counterparts who received balanced crystalloids. So interestingly, the subgroup analysis that showed patients in the medical ICU and those suffering from sepsis benefited more from balanced crystalloids, and those who were suffering from traumatic brain injury may have benefited more from saline.
So what I'm hearing you say is that balanced crystalloids like lactated ringers or plasmolite may be the right choice for many patients, but we should really tailor our fluid choice to our patient's pathophysiology.
Yeah, that's right. There's really no substitute for a careful history and physical exam and then ordering what we think is best for the child. As we said earlier, this is what we try to do with every medication we prescribe, and fluids really should not be any different.
You've referenced a couple times already that patients receiving saline might be at a higher risk of developing renal dysfunction. Why is this the case?
I don't want us to go off too far of a tangent, but there is evidence that high chloride solutions might actually reduce blood flow to the kidneys through something called the tubuloglomerular feedback.
Wow, so what is tubuloglomerular feedback?
This basically means that the distal nephron has the ability to regulate blood flow to the glomerulus. There's a specialized group of cells in the distal convoluted tubule called the macula densa. The macula densa has the ability to sense the concentration of chloride in the filtrate. Increased chloride levels in the DCT are able to feedback to the glomerulus and lead to vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole, reducing blood flow to the glomerulus. The take-home point here is that high chloride-containing IV fluids may lead to vasoconstriction of the artery supplying the nephron, reducing glomerular filtration rate and worsening kidney function. The concern is that our septic patients, or those with chronic kidney diseases, who are at the highest risk of having AKI, high chloride level containing fluids like 0.9% saline might increase the risk of adverse kidney outcomes. The clinical significance of tubuloglomerular feedback and the debate of saline versus balanced crystalloid is still ongoing, so stay tuned for more pediatric-specific data.
So that definitely got complex fast. Overall, it seems that there might be a modest amount of evidence that balanced solutions might be a good idea for that undifferentiated sick patient when we don't know exactly what's going on. Are there any scenarios when saline might be the right choice?
Yeah, absolutely. One thought is that if your patient has been vomiting and has a metabolic alkalosis, they're likely to be hypochloremic, and saline's a great choice. Another key indication for saline is TBIs, or traumatic brain injuries, where we sometimes use hypertonic solutions, and this was also supported by the SMART trial. On the other hand, if your patient's already acidotic and may be septic, it makes a lot of sense to use a balanced crystalloid that will not worsen this acidosis and may even be helpful towards the patient-centered outcomes that were used in the SMART trial. The 2020 Pediatric Surviving Sepsis Guidelines also suggest using balanced crystalloids for the same reasons.
And hopefully we can get some pediatric evidence soon to better guide our management.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we wrap things up?
Yeah, keep in mind that even if there's a very small benefit to balanced crystalloids, this actually could be a huge deal for our patients. Nearly every single hospitalized patient receives some volume of IV fluids. Even a 1% benefit for clinically significant outcome could help thousands of patients every year.
Excellent. The correct dosing of fluids applies to nearly all of our patients. Dr. Cagle, we've covered so much information today. Do you want to finish by giving our listeners some take-home points?
Sure. First, remember that hyponatremia in hospitalized patients is common, and this is likely due to the syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone secretion, or SIDH. Next, hyponatremic encephalopathy can be a fatal complication that often presents with nonspecific symptoms and thus making the diagnosis very difficult. Third, limit the risk of hyponatremia by carefully considering the dose and duration of IV fluids and choose isotonic fluids when appropriate. Finally, balanced crystalloids like plasmolite and lactated ringers may be superior to normal saline in most hospitalized patients, but stay tuned for more pediatric-specific data.
Well, thanks so much, Dr. Cagle, for coming on the podcast. We'll have to have you back for another critical care topic soon.
Definitely. Thanks, Zach. I've had a great time today.
An additional thanks to Dr. Asif Mansouri and Dr. Gene Fisher, who also contributed to today's discussion. And thank you for listening to this episode from the Department of Pediatrics at the Medical College of Georgia. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at mcgpediatricpodcast@augusta.edu. Please remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you receive your podcasts, so you'll be notified each time we release a new episode. Remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as medical advice to diagnose or treat any particular patient. Clinical vignette cases are based on hypothetical patient scenarios. We look forward to speaking with you on our next episode of the MCG Pediatric Podcast.